May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our Rock and our Redeemer. Amen. See, I set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. Now choose life, so that you and your children may live, and that you may love the Lord your God. Of course we would choose life. That's our whole purpose here on earth, isn't it? Of course we want to have long and happy lives and want the best for our children too. We want to enjoy life to its fullest, savor everything there is to it. We want the best that we can get. Of course that's difficult, we know. The world often seems against us. We face many challenges and setbacks. We fear missing out on what others enjoy. And so there's always the gap between what we think life should be like and what life is really like. There are times when life is good, when all our designs come to fruition. There are times when nothing goes right, when things just do not pan out as we have envisioned. And so then maybe our expectations of life wither to a tiny stub of resentment. In some way, we are always looking for the good life. Some have worked out the secrets to that good life, we think, and they sell many books. So what does our reading from the wise book suggest? For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, and to keep his commands, decrees, and laws. Then you will live and increase. Commanding us to love the Lord our God, is that not something a bit paradoxical? After all, we think of love as something that we freely give because of some attraction. The Old Testament concept of love certainly includes that. But it sees the basis of love more in faithfulness, committing one's life to someone else. Loving is to be loyal in all circumstances of life, to subject our own purposes to those of love. And then the next part of the reading from Deuteronomy suggests that part of the way that leads to life is to keep commands, decrees, and laws. That sounds quite restrictive. That's not the way we would expect to find the fullness of life. And so we often disregard this way as Old Testament religion and turn to the New Testament instead. But when we turn to the New Testament, we hear passages as the one we read today. And it seems hard, harder than most commands of the Old Testament. Indeed, when I looked up the lectionary readings for today, I thought it might be a good Sunday to depart from the lectionary and preach about something easier. For these are not the words of Jesus, meek and gentle. This is not a love that does not care what we do. It seems more like the strictest interpretation of the law. If we take all this seriously, we have to recognize that there is something deeply wrong with us humans, that we often do not know what is right, indeed, that we often choose what does not lead to life. Paul puts it in the following words in the letter to the Romans. We know that the law is spiritual, but I am unspiritual, sold as a slave to sin. I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do, I do not do, but I do what I hate to do. And if I do what I do not want to do, I agree that the law is good. As it is no longer I myself who do it, but it is sin living within me. That sin causes humans to act against what is good, even though they often know what should be done instead. Of course, many people are so immersed in destructive social or ideological patterns that they even think of their actions as good and right, when in fact they lead to misery. That's why God's laws need to remind us all how to direct our lives and where it is better not to go. God's laws show up our sin, but then also our need for forgiveness and grace. And God's law can show us a better way. By the time of Jesus, many Jews had become concerned about the exact boundaries of the law. How far could you go without infringing the law? That became the central question. What behavior is outside and what behavior is inside the line? And the task of the righteous Jew was to try and keep within those boundaries and ensure also that the whole household would stay inside the boundaries of the law. The Jews recognized that it was easy to unknowingly cross that thin line, and therefore they tried to keep back from the boundary. They put a safety buffer between their actions and that legal provision that could not be crossed. For example, the prohibition not to cook a young goat in its mother's milk was taken very seriously, and many of the stricter kosher food laws were built around this. As you could never know exactly where the milk came from, it was better not to cook any meat in milk, just in case. And it's better not to restrict this just to goats, but maybe rather to all animals. And animal meat also included chicken and other fowl, even though there certainly would never be any chicken milk. Fish, on the other hand, were considered suitably removed from goats to conclude that they could indeed be cooked in milk. That's why still today, tuna pizza is a thing among Jews, but pepperoni pizza is a strict no-no. Another example of that caution were the boundaries around the Sabbath. We read, "Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor the alien within your gates." The question then was, what was work and what was not? Some held that walking was working, and so a certain distance was described as the maximum a person could walk on the Sabbath, the Sabbath journey. Some villages later even had markers around them, showing the maximum extent somebody could walk from the village without exceeding the Sabbath journey. Keeping within the limits of the Sabbath regulations became more important than having a rest, ceasing from work and dedicating a day to the Lord. I could go on. The laws multiplied and the boundaries were discussed and defined ever more exactly, so that in the end, the original laws disappeared behind a whole host of detailed regulations. So, does Jesus participate in this discussion and definition by setting even stricter laws than the Pharisees? I don't think so. Rather, he criticizes all this preoccupation with the exact boundaries of the laws and instead points towards the center and meaning of the laws. Now, at this point, let me make a slight detour to more modern academic debate to show the difference between a focus on limits and a focus on the center. I know it from the field of archaeological theory, but it's applicable in many other fields, particularly in the social sciences and history. And I think there's a PowerPoint there. Do we have a slide there? Oh, that's it? No? Can you see that? So I'll explain it to you. To order and make sense of data out there, we have to categorize them. So all these little dots are observations of data. One of the most scientific ways to categorize is to set clearly defined limits. That's the lines drawn there. And so that our categorization is not biased, we set them at regular intervals. So it's very regular. That means our categories certainly are not biased, but they are very arbitrary. You see the lines going through clusters of data there. In archaeology, for example, a bowl with a circumference of 14 centimeters may be in one totally different category from a bowl with a circumference of 16 centimeters, because you set the limit at 15 centimeters. The first may be in the same category as a jug, the latter in the same as a baking tray. What, with a bit of common sense, would belong together is separated, and that which is in fact quite different is lumped together. Can we have the next slide? Same data points. The regular boundaries may be moved a bit to make them fit the data a bit better. That makes them more biased, but less arbitrary. For many purposes, nevertheless, that still is not adequate. Can we have the next slide? Instead, the solution many scholars have used was to design custom boundaries, little boxes that can tell us whether something should belong to this category or that. The debate about where the limits can get quite bitter and acrimonious. One of the more contested debates, for example, is what measurements define a Neanderthal. What are the exact skull measurements that define the classification? When is it a Homo sapiens, when a Homo Neanderthalis? Well, that's in biology, but once you get to other social concepts like household or family, the debate gets even more acrimonious. What is the exact limit? What is the exact definition of a household? Others, can we have the next slide? Others, and I include myself among them, unfortunately, I hope you can see that, have argued for a different approach to describing the data out there, namely by describing the typical, the center of a certain category, and then looking at the boundary is more the further you are away from the center rather than a strict boundary. For example, I can describe what a typical bowl looks like, but recognize that there are normally some variation around a central type of a bowl. Sometimes something lies between two different types and could be classified as either of those. Now that's in the academics, but a similar approach may also help us to define social realities. Getting to an example raised by today's reading, we might wonder what the limits of marriage are. Does gender matter? Does the type of commitment matter? And what about love? However, if you look at its center, marriage is probably best described in terms of the Book of Common Prayer, as the union between one man and one woman, so long as both shall live, for the procreation of children, the satisfaction of carnal desires, and the mutual society, help and comfort in prosperity and adversity. That's 1662. Some marriages, for example, those that from the outset are not for the procreation of children, are not at the center of marriage, but they are still within the sphere of marriage. As the intended way of life departs further and further from the center, the more it leaves the characteristics of marriage behind, and at some point it certainly can no longer be called marriage, but some other arrangement. Maybe some of today's arguments stem from a fixation on the boundary rather than a focus on the center of marriage. So that's my academic detour. Let's get back to our gospel reading. Jesus suggests that if we look at such laws as do not murder, do not commit adultery, do not break your oath, which are good laws, we should not so much focus on the boundary. We shouldn't argue when we might still get away with killing somebody or doing harm to our fellow human, but rather we should look at the center of this command and deal with the anger and enmity that sets one person against another, one group against another, and nation against nation. We should not let injustices fester. We should rather work for reconciliation now at the first opportunity we get. Similarly, when he discusses adultery, we should not think to what degree we can get away with inappropriate sexual advances or infidelities. Rather, we need to move to the center of this command, which is about faithfulness. It is about the beauty of sexual attraction, of family, and corresponding vulnerability and dependence. Maybe I could use C.S. Lewis' description as a way to illustrate the poles of the sexual tension. He says that a human's heart is torn between a terrestrial and an infernal Venus. The terrestrial Venus is based on the desire to hold and cherish, colored all through with that golden light of reverence and naturalness. The infernal Venus desires brutally and treats the other as a slave, an idol, or an accomplice, so that there's a tang of felt evil in the relationship. It's not so important to know where the exact boundary between the terrestrial and the infernal Venus is, but rather what we tend towards. Jesus directs us to faithfulness and reminds us of the seriousness of the relationship between a man and a woman. Now, the last part of the Bible reading, we didn't have that today, but it looks at oaths and swearing oaths. That is really about the matter of truthfulness. We should not, in that matter, we should not explore the limits of what still counts as keeping an oath and what does not. Rather, we should be truthful and unequivocal in our answers, for oaths can be bent in many directions. Indeed, that the boundaries of oaths can be highly contentious is shown by the fact that there's a whole Mishnah tract on the keeping of oaths. So that's a Jewish book of discussion and regulations about a certain topic of the law. And there's a whole book about when you keep oaths and when is it still an oath and when don't you. It's actually quite an interesting book. So in the collect, we gave thanks to God for giving us laws to guide our lives. I invite you to look at the center of those laws rather than exploring how far we can go without breaking their intent and substance. If we choose life, we are indeed called to love the Lord our God and to walk in his ways and to keep his commands, decrees, and laws. But when we do this, we should not focus on how much we can get away with, but rather what good and holy purposes God is calling us to. Amen.